because we're members one with another with that person. So a neighbor is a fellow Christian in other New Testament terminology. Jesus had already captured the present thinking of the day in the mind of the Jew when on the Sermon on the Mount, he says, "You've heard it been said by your rabbis, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy." There it is. There's the boundary. If somebody can fall outside of that word neighbor and get into enemy territory, I'm absolved of God's law. And that was the popular thinking. Why is the lawyer asking this question, though? Well, the passage says that he did it to justify himself. That's in verse 29. Desiring to justify himself, he asked, "Who is my neighbor?" To justify, to vindicate himself. We've already talked about what happened in John 7 when the Pharisees and lawyers didn't accept John's baptism. But those who did accept John's baptism were people like tax collectors and Roman soldiers. And when they subjected themselves to that baptism, do you know what they were doing? They were justifying God. They were saying, you know what? God is right in what he's asking. God is just. He's vindicated in asking me to do this, and I'm going to do it. Also in Luke in chapter 16, the Pharisees, they were lovers of money, and Jesus just got done talking about money, and "You're ridiculous, Jesus," is what they told him. And he said, "You are those who justify yourselves before men. You vindicate yourselves before men. You declare your own righteousness. But God knows your heart." So this man is trying to justify himself. The question is, to whom is he trying to justify himself? Is it to God? Is he trying to earn favor with God, maybe? Is he trying to excuse himself in the eyes of other people, maybe? Is he trying to justify himself in his own conscience, maybe? But the bottom line is, who is my neighbor that I am required to love? And that brings us to the parable of the Good Samaritan. So I have it up here on the screen. We'll just walk through the parable. Verse 30, Jesus replied and says, "A man was going down." And of course it says going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, not because Jericho was south of Jerusalem. It's actually north and east. But going down because topographically, Jerusalem's on the summit, right? And all roads leading from there go down, terrain-wise. So he's going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, a very dangerous trip before the Roman roads actually hit this area. So it's just going through these rocky crags and around bends, kind of a desolate, narrow road, about 15 miles in distance, 15 to 20 miles in distance, and I think a 2,000-foot drop in elevation, something like that. And he's going down the road by himself. And it's a famous place for robbers in this time, and even I read a story of a guy in 1820 that on the same road, an Englishman, was assaulted and killed by robbers on this same journey. And these robbers, bandits, thieves, the type of people that Jesus was arrested with, one on the right and one on the left, this is Barabbas-type company, they take him and strip him, steal everything off of him, including his clothing, and they beat him. A word that means they inflicted blows, not necessarily to the point of death, This is the same sort of word that's used when Paul and Silas are in that Philippian town of Philippi and they beat them and they wind up in jail and there are wounds that need to be tended to because they've been beaten. And they leave him and they leave him half dead, which is the only half dead is the only place that this shows up in the New Testament. Luke uses this term. And I don't know how much his medical background caused his use of terms here, but I'm sure it had some influence. So there's the guy lying in the sand, maybe semi-conscious, maybe unconscious, maybe an eye open, dirt up against his face possibly, body aching, exposed to the sun maybe that was shining down, beating on him. How long he lay there, we know not. But by chance, he hears footsteps. By chance. It's a word that means accidentally. Maybe the man could look out of the corner of his eye and as his vision is blurred, he's trying to focus on this figure that's approaching down that same road, coming down from Jerusalem to Jericho. And he sees it's a priest. He's dressed in the priestly garments, possibly. And the man's heart leaps. Help is here. Now the priest, as he was going down that road, probably aware of the danger himself, possibly going to Jericho, because many priests in that day lived in Jericho, and as their duties took them temporarily to Jerusalem, they would travel up and then travel back down and settle in Jericho and have a very comfortable living there. This priest may be on his way home from his religious duties. He stops. He sees this figure, disfigured, lying on the ground. His heart starts beating. He focuses in on him. He sees that it's a man, beaten, left, dying, maybe dead. And what does he do? He passes by on the other side and goes his way. The beaten man maybe sighs and groans, maybe can't form words to ask him to stop and help, but it's too late. He's on the way. He's passed. Sometime later, likewise, a Levite, not a priest, but someone who can trace his roots back to Levi, the tribe of Levi, who would have helped with the temple worship, not in leading sacrifices like the priest did, possibly leading in music, working in the temple, cleaning, providing security. He approaches the man at the same place. And when his eyes fix on him, he has the same response. He passes by on the other side. Why? Why do these two men do this? Maybe it was risk of defilement. You know, they're in religious service, and if they touch a corpse, they're unclean. But if the priest, as I mentioned, was headed down that road, it's the same word that's used. The man's going down who got beaten, and the priest was going down as well. Seems like his duties were done, and he was actually just headed home for a break. Well, whatever the case, whatever was running through these guys' minds, it's clear that they're more concerned about their cleanliness, their religious duty, their own safety, than about the life of this man. And Jesus continues this story, and he says, but a Samaritan. At this point in the story, your reaction as a first century Jew is, did you just say Samaritan? You know, it would have been just a fine story if Jesus had said, in conclusion, after these two men, that an ordinary Jew came by. And he saw the man and took care of him. There's actually one commentator who thought that this passage had been changed and thought that the original wording was that it was not a Samaritan, it was a Jew. And the reason was is because the idea of a Samaritan stopping was so outlandish. He got it right. That was Jesus' point. It was a Samaritan that stopped by. That doesn't mean much to us. You know, a good Samaritan is a good person. We call people we like and admire good Samaritans. But ethnic, racial conflict, something that we know some, but really little, comparatively speaking, about in this country. Of course, we've had some atrocious signs of that. Racially driven, ethnically driven hatred recently in the news. But just think of this. Think about Jews versus Arabs. Think about Croatians and Serbs. We have a brother from Malawi who is here or at church with us on occasion that you know. And he's gone through some beatings from Islamists versus Christians. You have the Tutsis and the Hutus and the Rwanda genocide with 500,000 to 1 million people slaughtered. You have the Turks who, according to one news report, doesn't like much of anybody. In a survey, there are about around two-thirds or more of Turks express unfavorable views of the European Union, China, Brazil, Russia, Iran, and Israel, and the U.S. I'm not sure who's in their good favors. Well, in those modern-day examples of tensions, you just put in there, in the first century eyes, that's what it would be like for the Jews and the Samaritans. The Samaritans were a half-breed. They were immigrants who got deported into northern Israel after Israel fell, and they kind of assimilate themselves to the Israelites that were left, and they're a mixed breed. But the Samaritans, as Jesus knew them, were a despised people, despised racially, despised religiously, because they worshipped on Mount Gerizim, and the Jews worshipped in Jerusalem. And from the end of the 6th century BC onward, feelings just got worse and worse and worse between the two. So this Samaritan comes along. Who knows what he had been doing, but he was journeying. And he came to this spot where this beaten, forsook Jew was. And he sees him as well. The beaten man looks up, possibly hopeless now. Now a third person comes by. Hope is gone. My life is at an end. And maybe as his eyes adjust, he notices this guy's not from around here. Is that a Samaritan? And maybe at that point he thought his chances were less than zero. But this Samaritan had compassion. He had compassion. And there's the difference. He had pity. He felt sympathy. This word is used in the Bible either in response to someone calling out for help. Jesus, have mercy on us, and Jesus would have compassion. Or in response to just seeing people's needs. So Jesus is out. There's this large crowd, and they don't have, it seems like a smaller need, but they don't have food. And Jesus has compassion on them, both in their state of hunger and in their state of just kind of being without a shepherd, like without a shepherd. Jesus had compassion on bigger needs, like a woman who was following the procession, funeral procession of her only son. She was a widow. Jesus saw what was going on and had compassion and raised the boy. Or in another parable that Jesus tells in Luke, there's this father. He's been sitting on his porch day after day, wondering how his youngest son is doing. When he sees him afar off, he has compassion. This is the way God feels about sinners that come to him. So this man has compassion. His heart is moved. And he does what he can. He goes to him. He binds up his wounds using the cloth that he has. He takes out some olive oil that he has and some wine. He mixes it potentially and pours it over his wounds. And he gets off. He takes his own animal and he sets the man on the animal. And together they begin a slow journey to an inn nearby. Inns on this road are more like shelters. They're not five-star hotels. And maybe this traveler Samaritan had visited this place before himself. But he goes there and he takes care of him. He nurses him. And the next day, he can't stay longer, but he does what he can. He takes out 2 denarii, which is 2 days' wages, which for an inn, for the way it is, it's probably more than enough to cover the expenses. And maybe in a gesture to get this innkeeper to be serious about taking care of this guy, this Samaritan just loads him with this money. And he gives it to the innkeeper and he says, "Now you take care of him. You do what I did, you take care of him." And of course, whatever more you spend, our version says, "I will repay you when I come back." The Greek is very emphatic. It says, "I myself, when I return, I will repay you. I will see to it. You have my word on it. It's my voucher that I'm going to cover the cost. You just spend, and I'll make it up to you." The Samaritan lavishes on this man, this Jew. So Jesus concludes the story and asks this question to the lawyer, back to the lawyer. In verse 36, he says, "Which of these three?" These are choices: the priest, the Levite, and the Samaritan, right? "Which of these three do you think," put on your thinking cap here, "proved to be the neighbor to the man who fell among robbers?" Not as a lawyer first asked, "Who's my neighbor?" but "Which of these proved to be a neighbor?" Which of these, the Greek is, became the neighbor? So let's look back through this in the eyes of the priest and the Levite. Just trying to draw some biblical principles here. The priest and the Levite, they had good reasons not to stop. Religious cleanliness, righteousness before God, keeping the law. And in the end, Jesus tells them that they were law breakers. From the priest and Levite, we learn that religious position and scrupulous attention to the letter of the law never earn favor with God, and it never excuses a lack of love. We see from them that to love is to fulfill the law of God. And the lesson can be summed up in a verse from Hosea chapter 6, which, interestingly, Hosea 6 may be the background, or one of the backgrounds of the Old Testament, that Jesus was thinking of when he told this parable, because there are parallels between this passage and the passage in Hosea 6. for the priest and Levite, God would say, Hosea 6:6, I desire steadfast love and not sacrifice. The knowledge of God, how God would really act in a situation like that, rather than burnt offerings. Through the eyes of the Samaritan, we see that compassion, remember he felt compassion. Compassion is required for those in dire need, regardless of what barriers may exist. And that the need, not the worthiness of the person in need, nor the worthiness of the person helping with the need, but the need is what calls for action. It doesn't matter who he is. It doesn't matter who I am. The issue is there's a need, and that's what calls for action. And that's what the Samaritan showed. From the eyes of the man beaten and left for dead, we learn that even one's enemies can become a neighbor. You know, did that man complain when the Samaritan started binding his wounds? Probably not. This is a Samaritan helping me? This isn't quite a parallel, but I remember Josh Jensen, missionary to Cambodia now, sharing with us about a man that they met from the people groups that they went to minister. And this man actually came to Christ because he was in the hospital. And in hospitals over there, I guess you're kind of on your own. Your family has to come and support you and give you food and clothing and all that. And that happens in many cultures. This man didn't really have anybody to care for him. But there were some Christians of that people group that came to the hospital, and they were just going around ministering to other people. And it was through their ministry that this man came to know the Lord. And I don't think that these people were enemies with this guy, but you know, anybody can become your neighbor. And if you're dealt with like this, if you're dealt with compassion, usually that helps break down the barriers. Help is appreciated from whoever gives it, usually. Through the eyes of the lawyer, notice in verse 37 when Jesus said, which of these men was a neighbor? The lawyer's uneasy to say Samaritan. He says instead, the one who showed him mercy. He didn't say, oh yeah, that was a Samaritan. I can see that. Well, he saw it, but he was a little uneasy in seeing it. But he recognized what the Samaritan did. He showed mercy. And from the lawyer, we learn, I think, this point, in which I think is the main point of the passage, the way I understand it, is that Jesus' kingdom calls for revolutionary practices. What does it mean to love God and to love your neighbor? Hang on. You haven't begun to think what it means. So, how did the lawyer feel when he left Jesus? We mentioned the rich young ruler, and we know at the end of that story, Jesus says, go and sell everything you have and follow me, and you'll have eternal life. The ruler leaves sad because he was very wealthy and he didn't want to give it up. What's this lawyer think when he leaves? The Bible doesn't say. Was he thinking, what does it mean to live like this? How could I live like this? If he thought that, he understood the point of what Jesus was saying. You can't. God's requirement is that you love God with all your heart and love your neighbor as yourself. And guess what? You can't. Not like this. But I can. Come to me. Through the eyes of Jesus, you know, Jesus had some dealings with a Samaritan. There was a woman from Samaria who came to draw water, John 4 tells us. And Jesus asked a drink from her. And they get into this long discussion. And she shows her Samaritan background, talking about Mount Gerizim, and that's where we worship, and you guys worship in Jerusalem, and which is right. And Jesus concludes his conversation with her. He says, believe me, the hour is coming where mountains don't matter anymore. The hour is coming when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth, because that's what God is looking for. So what does it mean to be a good Samaritan? I haven't talked a lot about social action. And that's because I think we need to stick with the background of the parable. A life-changed, revolutionary type living is what Jesus is calling us to. But I think one author who wrote a book on the parables has this helpful statement. The example of physical help in the story does not rule out corresponding truths at a spiritual level. So he's saying the fact that physical help shows up in the parable of the Good Samaritan, that doesn't mean that we should limit our application of that to physical help. He says, indeed, from an eternal perspective, evangelism must always take precedent over social action, including crossing enemy lines, however crucial both tasks remain. So what does it mean to be a good Samaritan? Let me ask this. Who is our neighbor? See that picture up there? About a month ago, as I was starting to think about this passage in relation to this sermon, I got a magazine, and one of the full-page ads on the magazine was from World Vision. Actually, the magazine may have been from World Vision. And it's this picture of this little girl. She's an Iraqi refugee. And World Vision, according to their purpose statement, says that they tackle the causes of poverty and injustice as a demonstration of God's unconditional love for all people. You know, who is your neighbor? Well, with today's technology, the world is your neighbor. You become instantly aware from one person's post on Facebook of refugees in Iraq, orphanages in Sudan, victims in Brazil, malnourished children in the Congo. Well, what can I do? Well, with today's technology, I can go there myself. I can take trips. I can contribute. The question is, what am I supposed to do? I was talking about this last week with a friend. We had lunch together. And this friend told me that as a family, they decided some time ago to support children in a certain country, personally as a family. I thought, I haven't even thought about it. I've been thinking about the sermon. I haven't even thought about doing that. The possibilities are endless. So I can make application and say, you must adopt children from Russia or China, or you must support water in Africa, or you must. Well, after that lunch, my friend and I were walking out, having just had this conversation. And we met a guy who approached us and he said, hey, listen, let me tell you my story. So we got ready and listened to his story. So the story was that he was stranded here, supposed to get a job, it fell through, needed a place to store stuff just for the weekend until he could get back to where he was going. And he needed $16.50. Could we help him out? What's a good Samaritan supposed to do? So we said, well, we don't have time for this. We'll see. thanks for lunch. That was a good discussion. No, we talked to him, and this is where I think wisdom is just so necessary. This Samaritan saw this man in dire need. So we talked to this guy and started asking him questions. Didn't want to interrogate him, but wanted to check his facts and see what it said about his story. And it's hard to tell. But something I found working here with outreach is that it's helpful to just kind of throw things back on people that are asking. Just to, in our culture, in our day, because so many people are making up things, really. So he said he needed $16.50 for storage. And I said, okay, where's the storage facility? He said, well, I'm not from around here. I don't know where it is. I said, that's fair. You know. I said, tell you what, I'll give you my number. I said, if you can locate that storage facility and give me a call, then I can go down there and pay the storage facility myself. And then, you know, for the amount you said and for the time you need, and then you can have your storage. So I'm not handing him money directly, you know, and I'm not writing him off completely, but I'm putting the burden back on him. So it ended up, we left. I haven't heard from him since then. Maybe he found somebody else to help him. I don't know. But, you know, that just goes to show that people expect people from churches or people that dress well or, you know, this persona, people who go out to lunch, people expect them to help other people. And we need to be careful. We need God's wisdom. But at the same time, we need that heart of the Samaritan, compassion. And we need help really distinguishing the level of help that we give and the level of need that there may be. So I don't have the answers for you. I just have possibilities to raise and let you scratch your own head. Let me close with this, and then we'll close with a song. Apparently, about a year ago, the rock singer from U2 group, Bono? Is that how you say his name? Anybody familiar with pop culture? Bono? I'm getting a thumbs up from Lance. That's good. He knows his music stuff, so. Bono had some sort of accident up in Central Park, New York City, and a fairly serious accident on a bicycle. I'm not sure if it's one of those pedaling bicycles or riding bicycles, but an accident. I'm assuming pedaling because it was in Central Park. So bad, he actually had a facial fracture around his eye, separated shoulder blade, fracture of his humerus bone in his upper arm. So anyways, pretty beat up. So what ended up happening is that a lady that was jogging up through there saw him and ended up calling 911. So we got a person here, and I don't know if she knew who it was at the time, but she called 911. The firemen come out, the medical people come out, and they rush him off to the hospital, and he gets the attention he needs. Well, from what I understand, this past week, Bono was back in New York City for a concert. And at the beginning of his concert, he said, I'd just like to say thank you to the firefighters who are seated here, and they were right up front row seats, who came to my rescue during this accident. He referred back to the accident. And he said, and I'd like to thank the lady who's here, a beautiful lady from Denver, is what he said, who called 911 and helped. So the firefighters, he actually hands the firefighters the mic, and they say, you know, we love you. We'll always be here for you. Come to the fire department after this concert. We'll feed you dinner. And you call us. You need us, you call us. You know? And everybody's cheering because people like firefighters in New York, right? So then they hand the mic to this girl, and her name is Alyssa. And she says, well, first of all, my name's Alyssa, and I'm from D.C., not Denver. And it's kind of with that tone. She says, but Bono, here's what happened. I was running in Central Park and there was an accident. Obviously, I had to stop and help you because I'm not from New York. I'm from Virginia, where people are nice. Anyway, I called 911 because no one else was going to do it. He would not be here tonight if it weren't for me. In front of thousands of New Yorkers, she says this. And obviously gets booed quite a lot, quite a bit. So is this a good Samaritan? Is this someone whose heart is changed through Christ's work and displays that love? Obviously, in our terminology, what she did was a good Samaritan act and the way we use it, but from the passage, it's not a good Samaritan. Only Christ can make someone a good Samaritan. So as we close, we're going to sing a hymn, Not I But Christ, that talks about extending mercy, to wipe tears, to cheer the brokenhearted. But it's a prayer that it, even when that's happening, that it not be from us, not be about us, but that it be Christ, not I but Christ, that does it. May the Lord help us to do that.